Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another new episode of New Books in Islamic Studies, which is part of the New Books Network. I'm your co-host, Shobana Xavier. Thank you so much for joining us. As you know, in each new episode of New Books in Islamic Studies, we engage with a new book that has been published in the field of Islamic studies, as it is broadly defined, and we have a conversation with the author. Realizing Islam, the Tijaniya in North Africa, an 18th century Muslim world, published by the University of North Carolina Press as part of their series Muslim Networks in 2020, by Zachary Valentine Wright, who's an associate professor in residence in history and religious studies at Northwestern University in Qatar, maps the intellectual history of the largest Sufi order in West and North Africa, the Tijaniya. Using diverse primary and archival sources, some for the first time, Wright locates the life, teachings, and legacies of Sheikh Hamad al-Tijani within broader 18th century Islamic scholarly milieu of jurisprudence and theology and reformist and revivalist discourses, as well as the social and political climate of broader European colonialism and Ottoman control in places like the Algiers. Here, it is the modality of tahqiq, or verification, as it was formulated through visionary encounters of the Prophet Muhammad and al-Tijani that led to the formative epistemologies that define the Muhammadian path, or Tariqa Muhammadiyya, of the Tijaniya. This path, which is centered on the living legacy of the Prophet Muhammad, then defined Tijaniya conceptions of the human condition and the Sheikh-Murid relationship, or the master-disciple relationship, but also metaphysical, esoteric, and theological ideas and practices, such as notions of sainthood. Overall, the book offers fresh and insights into the wide intellectual and networked traditions that led to the development of the Tijaniya, Sufism, and Islam in North Africa. The book will be of interest to those who work on Islam in West and North Africa, but also scholars of Sufism generally. The book is also open access, which is great, and available online. So it will be a useful and accessible resource for courses on Islam and Sufism, especially in continental Africa, especially as we're going into teaching online. In today's conversation with Professor Zachary Valentine Wright, I spoke to him about some of his methodological process in writing this book, and also more about the visionary experiences that were so informative for defining the Tijaniya, as well as broader political and social dynamics that were unfolding that also informed the development of the Tijaniya. So without further ado, here's my conversation with Professor Zachary Valentine Wright about his new book, Realizing Islam, the Tijaniya in North Africa and the 18th century Muslim world. Hi, Zachary. Thank you so much for joining us today. As you may know, we have a tradition in New Books in Islamic Studies that we like to start our conversation by asking our guests to share something, a little bit of their intellectual journey and what led them to writing this book. So can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, thank you, Shabana, for having me on, first of all. It's an honor to be part of the program. So my intellectual journey really started in, I would say, 1997, when I was first an undergraduate at Stanford University. And at that time, I got this undergraduate research grant to go to Senegal. And mind you, I'd never been, grew up in New Hampshire, kind of son of hippie kids, and never had been really outside of America. So I ended up in Senegal in a place called Medina by Kaolack, which is considered one of the sort of holy towns of West Africa. And it's a center for the Tijaniya Sufi order in particular, but also, you know, long specialization in Islamic learning going back centuries. So I found myself in this town confronted with, scholars from a very rich tradition about which I knew hardly anything about. And so that sort of, you know, and then when I ended up actually, you know, converting to Islam at that time. And you know, so part of this was a personal exploration also. But then, you know, when I came back and started to try to research, because I had access to different libraries with the university systems, I really found that the history of African Muslim identities, you know, seemed to be consistently peripheral to discussions of kind of Islamic orthodoxy, and, you know, the Tijaniya being the sort of largest Sufi order on the African continent, and the majority of African Muslims probably still practice Sufism in one form or another. This became a very important question for the study of African Muslim identities, the representation of this particular Sufi order. And so when I got, you know, back to Stanford and started reading the literature that had been published at that time about the Tijaniya, I just found this great disconnection between the people that I had known and come to love and this sort of these sort of pejorative accounts of African Muslims in general and the Tijaniya in particular. And so that really made me want to do more research about the subject. And so I ended up writing an undergraduate honors thesis at Stanford, kind of about Islam and colonialism in West Africa. And then I went to the American University in Cairo to do a master's and learn a little bit more Arabic. And that's when I really, and then after that, I got a Fulbright language grant to go study further in Morocco. And that's when I did the research for my master's thesis on the Tijaniya. And that later got published as a sort of introductory text. And that had a wide reception, you know, kind of lots of people found it, you know, useful. I think for me, it was sort of a surface level discussion. The book was called On the Path of the Prophet, Sheikh Ahmad Tijani and the Tariqa Muhammadiyya. But it got translated into French and then sections into Portuguese and Spanish and Indonesian and Malayam. And so then I started to realize that this was a much larger conversation. And so then after I kind of, you know, went back to do my PhD work in more Islam in West Africa, more specifically. And then after I published the book that came out of the dissertation and did some other primary translations of primary source material that I wanted to do, I finally was able to return to this earlier research I had done in Morocco. And I had some other more recent funding to return to Morocco and assess new publications and that sort of a thing. So, so that was my earlier interest. And then the sort of impetus to really write this new book was, I think, necessitated by, you know, my continued access to Tijani communities in North and West Africa, and my realization, really, of a whole lot of new sources that, I mean, they weren't new, but they were new to, I think, the academic community that I had seen. And this was, manuscript collections of very interesting nature, stuff that hadn't been published. And then also the kind of new publications in the field of, related to the Tijaniya, primarily coming out of Morocco, stuff that I, was really being published since 2012. And these are really amazing, resources also that I was able to avail myself of that I don't think previous researchers had properly been able to do. So that's the sort of backstory of why this book came out at this time and my personal connection to it.
I wonder if you could give us a little bit of the geographical setting of the region we're going to be talking about and the figure that's situated in the region. And you do that in the earlier sections of the book that really sets the scene. And as you say, to a context where a lot of people don't know about the scene, especially in the 18th century where you're locating some of the conversations.
Mm-hmm. Sure. So this is Sheikh Ahmed Tijani, who was born in 1737 in an oasis town of what's now the country of Algeria, Ain Mahdi. And he passed in about 1798. He moved permanently to Fez, then known as the sort of Baghdad of the Maghreb. It was the center of Islamic learning, as probably people well know. And he lived the last 17 years of his life or so in Fez, and that's where he's buried. So the Tijaniya Sufi order is part of a larger story of 18th century Islamic dynamism and vibrancy that really does, sort of span the Islamic world at the time. So my task was really to think about these connections across the globe. And Sheikh Mujani himself, did travel to across North Africa and to Egypt, and then also, of course, to make the pilgrimage and connects with a lot of these scholars that have intellectual, pedigrees and connections all the way into India and elsewhere, and back down into West Africa. So my task was really to think about the meaning of these connections, and then also to think about how this scholarly vibrancy was enacted in local contexts. So particularly in Algeria and Morocco. And then, of course, the question in the back of my mind, given that the Tijaniya really spread so successfully into sub-Saharan Africa, is, why? What about, Muslim identity as articulated by Sheikh Ahmed Tijani and his early companions really resonated with the conceptions of Islamic identity coming out of West Africa? And I'd known enough, of course, about Islamic intellectual history in West Africa to know that this is not a blank slate. Like, there were scholars established there for centuries. And so what were the things that they were thinking about that made them predisposed to accept or receive the Tijaniya into West Africa?
And I think the rest of the book really gets into some of these intellectual traditions thematically organized. But before we go into some of this detail, I really, and you mentioned this when you were introducing the process, I wonder if you could say more about your methodological process, but the sources that you found and how you went about finding them, but also some challenges that you encountered in engaging these sources. Because as I was reading your book, I just was kind of amazed by the depth and breadth of these sources. So I was really wondering what your relationship with the sources were and some of the challenges in reading them.
So the question about my access and use of sources is a really good one. So of course the Arabic primary source materials, first of all, important to realize that the dominant conception has been that Sheikh Ahmed Tijani was one of these saints that never really wrote anything, similar to Abu Hassan al-Shazari, who said, Kutubi ashabi, my books are my companions. But that other, of his companions, namely Sayyidi Ali Harazm and Muhammad bin Mishri, were the ones that wrote the primary source material. And so what's interesting about the testimony of these disciples is that they are often written during his life, and he is reading them, and he's commenting on them at the same time. So, but then, of course, the main text, the Juwahir al-Ma'ani, the Pearls of Meanings, has this sort of sacrosanct status within the Tijaniya, given that the the Prophet, peace be upon him, appeared to Shah Majani, according to the Tijani tradition, and said, you know, this is my book. So, and it's said to have barakah if you have it in your house and that sort of a thing. So, so this text had this certain status, and I think kind of had in a way sort of silenced other writings, and not purposefully, but that there, you know, so that there were a lot of other manuscript sources that are very useful for the early history of the Tijaniyya. And so, of course, some of these sources are not written by Tijanis themselves, like the histories of the Istisqa, you know, a book about, kind of written in the 19th century about this kind of period. By a Moroccan historian, and there's a couple of other sources, Salawat al-Anfas. And so these were very useful for me too, because they referenced a lot of the scholars that are mentioned in the Jawahir al-Ma'ani, but, you know, kind of mentioned in passing, so you could get a sense of who these people were and how they were connected. And then there were some other texts that, as I said, were just published. You know, books about Ibn Shakrun, for example, who was the kind of preeminent elder scholar in Fez when Shah Majani arrived. Also new writings by Hamdun Ibn al-Hajj, who is the preeminent Maliki jurist. So these were all things that had been in manuscript form. He was the Maliki jurist of Fez at the time of Shah Majani, and then ended up becoming a Tijani. But he wrote voluminous poetry, some of it in praise of Shah Ahmad Tijani. And he also wrote some very interesting letters in which he references, you know, very ardent defender of ideas associated with Ibn Arabi on Wahdat al-Wujud and unity of being, for example. That were very fascinating. And these things were really only published his name is Ahmed Iraqi. By a Moroccan historian that's active now. So these things are very useful, and, you know, I found them, you know, only in the last few years. And so these were resources that added a lot. And then, of course, there are the unpublished manuscript resources that are kind of jealously guarded among Tijani scholars, right? So, and one of the things that you know, was very useful was a 49-page handwritten travelogue by Shah Rajani himself, in which he documents his connections with various scholars as he went to make his pilgrimage. And this is when he was about 37. So it's from an earlier period of his life, but it really kind of throws you very quickly into the constellation of scholars he was associated with, what they were talking about, and that allowed me to sort of get a deeper understanding of what was going on in these scholarly connections and transmissions, because they were very, you know, very short. Oftentimes scholars were meeting each other for, you know, just a few days or maybe a month, a bit longer. And so the question that normally would arise is, you know, well, what does it really mean that so-and-so got ijazah or so-and-so got, you know, a knowledge investiture from a sheikh if you only met him for one or two days. So these kinds of manuscripts allow me to see much deeper into what the things they were talking about and how important they were for both on both sides. And so, you know, but, you know, of course the method. So, and then there's another account. This was a favorite source of mine was, so Shah Majani's closest disciple, Ali Harazm, who's also the author of the Jawahir al-Ma'ani, also kept like a journal on the side. And in this journal, which totals about 212 pages in the version that I had, in this journal, he records his, you know, visionary experiences that he himself is having of the Prophet and other prophets and other things that he's seeing on the unseen, kind of kashafat. And what's very fascinating is there, it's sort of like a dialogue between, so he's, you know, he's talking about these things that he's seen, he's writing letters to Shah Ahmad Tijani and he's recording their conversations. And it's like a dialogue about spiritual unveiling. So Shyamajani is saying, okay, when you see the prophet next time, then ask him this question. And then the prophet, when Adi Harazam sees the prophet in a vision the next time, then the prophet says, okay, now remember what I said and tell it to Shyamajani. So, and with the explanation. And so, you know, and tell him this and that. So this really fascinating insight into, the world of, you know, spiritual unveilings, the fact that people are like testing these or thinking about it. And also, of course, into the kind of intimacy of sheikh-disciple relations. So, of course, you know, methodologically, those sources are exist in very specific archives. And they take years of gaining trust, of course, to kind of look at them. And even when, you know, because, of course, there's a lots of esoteric knowledge that certain prayers that are, you know, transmitted only by permission. So my interest for this work was not in those prayers, of course, except where they had sort of they showed connections between people. But, you know, I think at the same time, and I think this is why certain scholars of the Tijaniya were sort of permissive of letting me look at these. They also contain very important historical data, right, explaining why Sheikh Ahmad Tijani, you know, stayed in Fez instead of, you know, at one point he wanted to move to Syria. And his decision to stay in Fez had a lot to do with, you know, the prophet coming and telling him something, you know. As I say in the book, these are, you know, not necessarily open access archives, but, you know, they do exist in multiple places. So, you know, they can be verified if one wants to go through the procedures. And at this, you know, at the same time, I also think it's important to admit that archives by and large are not all open access. They all have certain methodologies of licensing people's access to those. If you ever tried to access colonial archives in any place in the world, you know what I'm talking about, right? So these are not the easiest things to always access. And, you know, I don't think Muslim scholars who hold on to personal archives can be blamed for establishing their own licensing procedures by which to view those documents.
No, it's really interesting to hear about your process, because one of the things that I loved about the book was the diversity of a literature or a text that you were drawing from, like you mentioned, from prayers to different treatises to poems. And there were some instances where you do mention that, you know, you couldn't directly refer to the source, but you could refer to another disciple who was perhaps mentioning this particular prayer. So it was just kind of in a secondary reference. And so that kind of the primary text that you and kind of present in this book was really, really fascinating. And I loved reading it. And so one of the things that you mentioned is the Mohammedan path. And so this is obviously very central to the Tijani movement and the visionary experiences Sheikh Tijani had with the Prophet Muhammad. So I wonder if you could tell us the significance of this and what really made the Tijaniya distinct in this way as a Sufi order that was based on these visionary experiences with the Prophet, and then how it informed perhaps metaphysics and practices, but which you also argue is verifies and confirms the broader intellectual tradition, you know, be it jurisprudence or theology or notions of etiquette that are unfolding within perhaps the 18th century, North African context. I know that it's a lot there, but I think all of these pieces are really hinge on each other and really are the pillars of the book. So I wonder if you could unpack some of those pieces for us.
Right. That's a really good question or set of questions. I would say the Tariqa Muhammadiyya or the Muhammadan path is best defined as a sort of in the 18th century as a methodology of accessing the spirituality of the Prophet Muhammad, which was thought to be enduring, right? And so this was really a consensus since Jalaluddin Suyuti had you know, basically affirm that the Prophet has a life that's barzakhi, like he is alive. To say he's dead is not appropriate for a Muslim scholar. And Shaykh Ahmad Jani says this very clearly in the Jawahir al-Manis, and he says, you know, whoever, you know, certainly, of course, the Sharia is finished, the Islamic sacred law is finished, but whoever thinks that the Prophet Muhammad's madad or his spiritual support for his community has ended with his death, as in the case of other dead men, then he is guilty of disrespecting the Prophet's rank and in danger of dying as a disbeliever if he does not repent of his deluded conviction. So he's very, very stern in this regard. So this was a sort of consensus of scholars. I think obviously there were exceptions like Muhammad Wahhab and others, but even even Muhammad Wahhab, just to sort of demonstrate the importance of this Tariqa Muhammadiyya, this was the idea then that the only true Sufism was that directly connected to the Prophet Muhammad. So even Muhammad Wahhab in his letters references the Tariqa Muhammadiyya in a positive way, right? Saying that these people are on the path of truth. Now, the problem, of course, is that Tariqa Muhammadiyya meant different things for different people. And I think it's a mistake. Although people like Murtada Zabidi, the great Indian scholar resident in Cairo, Hadith scholar, he does speak about the Tariqa Muhammadiyya as a particular Sufi order in which he became initiated. So there were certainly like networks of people that, you know, transmitted these ideas. But the problem is that they mean very different things in different contexts, right? So the network of scholars surrounding Ahmed ibn Idris, for example, you know, have different ideas about Sheikh disciple relationships and then do the Tijaniyya, for example. There's also an instance of the Tariqa Muhammadiyya coming out of India, but no known connection to the Tijaniyya. So I think it's best described then as a methodology or a discourse that people were thinking about, were talking about, were putting into practice in a variety of different ways. And the primary Sufi practice, of course, that we're talking about in terms of dhikr or liturgical remembrance is simply Salat al-Nabi, right? The prayer upon the Prophet, which would, you know, of course, bring you into increasing proximity to the Prophet. And yeah, you might experience a dream or a waking vision of the Prophet as a result of those practices, but the overarching emphasis was on loving the Prophet and, you know, wanting to emulate him both zahir and wabatin, right, and externally and internally. So this was something that also included, you know, external aspects of your Islamic practice. Of course, your etiquette, like, you know, to try to be like the Prophet in all situations. Of course, that's easier if you're actually seeing the Prophet. and there are instances in which people are, you know, when hadith are related, they're saying, no, I don't accept that hadith. And they say, why? He says, because I'm looking at the Prophet right now and he's telling me no, right? then also entailed certain aspects of, you know, I think there was this emphasis then, as I say in the book, on returning to the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam as a method to make tahqiq, right? Or in Arabic, kind of like verification or actualization of the Islamic tradition. So this was not a disavowal of the Islamic tradition that 18th century scholarship, i.e. the Wahhabiyya, is sometimes associated with, right? They were not trying to throw out everything and go back to the Quran and Sunnah exclusively. These were trained people in the Islamic tradition. Shaykh Ahmad Jani was among them. And they were thinking about this, idea of returning to the personality of the Prophet as a means of verifying their inherited knowledge, right? As I say, this has certain, the process, tahqiq was a discourse then or a methodology that influenced, you know, Islamic law, theology, and Sufism, the so-called three queens of the Islamic sciences. But it's a method of implementation would differ depending upon the epistemology associated with that discipline of Islamic learning, right? So for fiqh, for Islamic law, then of course you're thinking about transmitted knowledge, right? How do you verify different reports, right? And so Sheikh Ahmad Jani then was really thinking about, for him, the idea of connecting to the Prophet Muhammad in this regard meant, okay, what is the established text, right? What is the nus in this case? And how does it relate to the tradition of jurisprudence? And so he is actually, I mean, we could also call this ijtihad, right? So he is actually rejecting some of the accumulated positions within the Maliki school while himself remaining a Maliki. So I think this is a good example of thinking about what 18th century scholarly vibrancy meant. It wasn't in the case of, he wasn't rejecting, he wasn't trying to throw out the madhahib, the inherited schools of Islamic jurisprudence, but rather to kind of return to some of these issues and say, okay, well, we do have to, after all, connect it to the Quran and the Sunnah, right? And so, so some examples of that would have been, the emphasis on making ablution or wudu with water instead of making tayammum. There's an opinion in the Maliki school that if the prayer time is about to go out and you fear missing the prayer time, then you can have a rock, or some sand and make your purification for prayer without water so you don't miss the time, right? And so their custom was to have a rock by their bed, so if they're sleeping late and they're about to miss the dawn prayer, they just get up and pat the rock.
Right.
So Sheikh Ahmad Jani was of the opinion that that's not, if you have water there in your house, that's not a legitimate opinion. You don't have an excuse not to. And he would base that based upon the Quranic ayat that when you stand to pray, you should have washed your faces. So this is an instance about how he's using this idea of tahqiq through access to the Prophet in Islamic law. And of course, in Sufism, then tahqiq takes on different epistemological preoccupations, right? So there's this, of course, going back to Al-Ghazali's idea of this, tripartite way of verifying knowledge, ilm al-naql, ilm al-aql, and then kashf. So knowledge by transmission, knowledge by reason or reflection, rational understanding, and then knowledge by direct unveiling. And so, of course, if you go back to somebody like Hassan al-Yusi, Justin Stearns has just done a fabulous translation of some of Yusuf, Hassan al-Yusi's works. So this is a Moroccan scholar of an earlier generation who was really kind of, what it demonstrates is that these kinds of stories about kashafat, unveilings have started to proliferate, and people are perhaps using them in the wrong way, and everybody's claiming, I saw the Prophet this and I saw the Prophet that. And so so I think what's going on with the Jijaniya is, it's not, one of the things that I was subtly pushing against is that kind of thinking about the Jijaniya in the previous literature had sort of made the Jijaniya an exception, right? That, okay, it's very different than the previous Sufi orders because Sheikh Ahmad Jani claimed to have seen the Prophet, and then that's their only vindication or their only justification for having founded a new Sufi order, right? And so I kind of wanted to point out that this was a methodology of verification that emerged within a larger scholarly preoccupation that Sheikh Ahmad Jani and like-minded intellectuals were involved in. And it was sort of a logical extension of this discourse on verification into the field of kashf, right? How do you, obviously there are spiritual unveilings. And later Tijani scholars will quote, previous scholars such as Abdul Habib Sharani, in talking about how, you know, miracles themselves are not, actually can be misleading, right? You can actually have a non-Muslim who can walk on the water. Does that mean his religion is the truth, right? And so you're thinking about these different types of verification in this field of spiritual unveilings, and going back to the hadith where the devil cannot take the form of the prophet in a visionary appearance, then people are saying, okay, this is the sort of most verified or most important type of kashf of spiritual unveilings, is to see the prophet. But of course, it's not everybody who's seeing the prophet is the same, right? And I think this is why the Tijaniya tradition lays a great emphasis on the actual words of the prophet in these spiritual encounters. And, you know, is the prophet actually commanding Shah Marjani to say things? One of the more interesting narrations in the Jawahir Mani is, you know, Ali Harazm saying, Shah Marjani, our sheikh, used to talk a lot about the things that he would see at the command of the prophet, but now he's mostly silent, right? And so I think this is a sort of lengthy answer to how the Tariqa Muhammadiyah as a methodology engenders a discourse on tahqiq. And people like Khalid Ruwayb at Harvard have already laid out the importance of this fascination with tahqiq and verification, actualization, extending back into the 17th century. And when we're talking about the 18th century, arguably this discourse is the thing that engenders these new vibrancy or new community basis of community organization that we're seeing with the Tijaniya and other Sufi and other types of groups that are coming from the 18th century. And this is an important story. I mean, I don't have to remind us, but these are the same groups largely that end up fighting colonial occupation in a series of Sufi-led jihads in the early 19th century. And, you know, arguably also this is a discourse within Sufism of kind of connecting, you know, rearticulating the orthodox foundations of Sufism as the sort of practice of the Prophet Muhammad, the way of getting close to the Prophet Muhammad. This is a discourse that arguably affects and causes a rearticulation of existing Sufi orders at the same time, right? So it's no accident then that you're going to find the Qadariya in North and West Africa saying very similar things to the Tijaniya at the same time. There are also, you know, Usman Tanforio in Nigeria, modern day Nigeria. Sokoto Caliphate is also having visions of the Prophet. And so there are, you know, the different Shaziliya traditions also. So I think this is, you know, rather than looking at the Tijaniya as this sort of historical anomaly, but rather it is rather a sort of part of a larger discourse of verification based upon, you know, this idea loosely associated with the Tariqa Muhammadiyya, perhaps, but not exclusively, of verifying the foundations of the Islamic tradition, and, you know, adapting it essentially into a new time.
And one of the things you do in chapter 3, which I found really interesting, is that in your discussion of, you know, one of the components you're talking about, this verification process, particularly through visionary experience, you're also saying that this was a mode in which it was cultivating Islamic humanism, particularly in light, I guess, of the political context and geographical context of what was happening at this time, which you turn to towards the end of the book. So can you say a little bit more about what you mean by Islamic humanism in this context, and how perhaps it was central to the Tijaniya?
Right, so that's the part of the book that maybe I've gone out on a limb, and perhaps other people would rightly, you know, push back. And so basically I'm using the word tahqiq al-insaniya in saying this is Islamic humanism, right? So basically the actualization of the human condition. And I want to suggest, you know, thereby, although, you know, I hope I've made those this hypothesis tentative as it should be, but I want to suggest that with the decline of the political entities in the Muslim world from the 18th century, late 18th century. And, you know, I think one of the interesting things is that, you know, it's easy to read these texts retroactively and say, well, colonial occupation was about to happen, or Napoleon just got into Egypt at the same time that Sheikh Marjani got into arrived in Fez. So therefore, he must be talking, the silent referent must be, you know, European colonial occupation. But reference to this is really, you know, absent from these primary sources. But there is a prominent discourse about decline, about corruption, about the injustice of political elites, about the fact that they're not implementing Islamic precepts correctly, by misappropriating people's wealth, by unjust practices of slavery, by making illicit things licit, right? And by just open practices of, you know, fornication and wine drinking and, you know, the normal kind of list of impious acts of which Muslim rulers were allegedly guilty of. So this was, I think a perceived decline of the justice of Muslim political power during that time, and so that I think during the scholars themselves kind of see collectively, I think, see themselves as the saviors of the Islamic tradition. They always saw themselves as that, but increasingly so, right? So they've always had this discourse about keeping your distance from the corruption of political power, etc. The best of, you know, kings is the one who visits scholars, and the worst of scholars is the one who visits kings, kind of a thing. But this is accentuated during the 18th century, whereby scholars themselves are really saying, we are the ones that are going to guard people's faith for them, right? It doesn't mean that they don't have any contact with political elites, because sometimes they do, and they see themselves as being called upon to justly advise and guide these political elites. But in terms of this actualization of Islamic identity, I mean, of the human condition, that I find, you know, that I'm kind of associating with this idea of tahqiq al-insaniya, or more particularly that actualization of human potentiality, basically, I find this an interesting coincidence, right? That this happens at the time, exactly the time when Muslim political power is disintegrating all around the Muslim world. And it's at the eve of colonial conquest. And so it's basically the Tijaniya and like-minded intellectual traditions, I think, are endowing their followers with an ability to think outside of the box of Muslim political power, right? They're endowing them with an ability to think about the continued spread and victory of Islam, even when political power is not there, right? Even when it's being eclipsed, right? And so there are some important methodologies or insights that this discourse on the human condition affords, you know, the followers of Sheikh Marjani. And one of the things is to think about the fact that there's an essential unity of all human beings, right? That Muslims are not somehow different in their basic insaniya and their basic humanity than our non-Muslims, right? And not only that, but they have to be respected, right? And, you know, you cannot hold yourself above non-Muslims in the creation, because doing so would be to show, you know, internally at least, that this would make you among the arrogant people who look down on Allah's creation. So I think this was and then there are many examples later on in the history of Tijani communities as they spread in Africa, where they kind of use this precept or this idea to engage with European colonial power, right? And, you know, arguably this is, you know, this engagement, I think, has been, is complex, of course. There were some Tijanis who fought political, you know, fought against European occupation. But, you know, by and large, this is, there's a sort of adaptation, or at least a recognition that we, you know, as long as there's people are leaving us alone to practice our Islam, then we can still flourish. And the later Tijani scholar, Sheikh Ibrahim Nias, put this very succinctly, and he said, you know, a Muslim can live for a long time in a place with no faith, but he can't last long in a place with no justice. And so by that, he wanted to think about, you know, and he even said, you know, authority is given and taken by God to people, not by on the basis of faith, but on the basis of how, of their justice. Okay. So I think this emphasis on the unity of all human beings engenders a discourse in Tijani communities. And I don't think it's exclusive to the Tijaniya by any means, but it engenders a discourse that allows people to think outside of this, you know, Dar al-Islam, Dar al-Harb dichotomy. That would, you know, if it had been followed, it would not have, you know, because essentially you have two reactions, right, to the British colonial occupation in Nigeria in the beginning. And one group says, we're out of here, right? These people are kufar, they're disbelievers. We cannot live under colonial occupation, and they leave, right? So that's obviously not the, it's a legitimate opinion. It's not the opinion of the majority in West Africa. And if everybody had taken that opinion, then it's you know, paradoxically, it's actually in the late 19th century, early 20th century, that Islam spreads, you know, rapidly in West Africa. So that, you know, the 90% Muslim population in Senegal today, you know, in fact, doesn't really take shape until the early 20th century, largely at the result of the proselytization efforts of, you know, Sufi sheikhs like Sheikh Amadou Bamba, Alhaj Malik Sy, and Sheikh Ibrahim Nias. So it's not exclusively a Tijani innovation, but I think it proceeds from, you know, ideas laid down by Ibn Arabi and many others. I do reference an earlier classical tradition of Islamic humanism. But it's something that the Tijaniya picks up on, and at a very critical historical juncture, and then that is taken by later Tijanis to allow them to live and actually spread and in their minds make Islam victorious right under the noses of European colonial occupation.
And I think towards the end of the chapter, end of your book, pardon me, it was really fascinating to see, because I think more of the political milieu that you're setting up is very explicit. And so you have the non-Muslim European colonizers, you have kind of the critique of the Ottomans, perhaps, in Algiers and their corruption. And then Tijani is shifting to Morocco at the end of the 18th century. And so they're also navigating, as you frame, kind of reformism and relationship with Wahhabism. So I think there's so much happening, both socially, politically, religiously. How do you think, I mean, you mentioned Islamic humanism. What are some perhaps other ways in which this context is informing Tijani, be it practice or theology? In this moment.
So the question is, what are some other ways in which Islamic humanism is informing the context? Can you repeat the question?
So much Islamic humanism, but more of the social climate and the political climate is informing other practices or theological ideas that are emerging out of the Tijani at this moment. Especially in light, I think I'm thinking really in terms of the reformist movement and then the relationship with Wahhabis, which you mentioned a little bit earlier, but it's something that I think you bring up more towards the end of the book.
Yeah, that's a good question. So I think rhetorically, the initial understanding of Wahhabism in Morocco, I mean, of course, there were disputes. Zayani, for example, came out very strongly against the Wahhabis. But generally, rhetorically, there wasn't much of a problem with what what the Moroccans understood the Wahhabis to be saying, right? Which was that you had to return to the Quran and the Sunnah, and that popular Islam has been guilty of certain innovations that should be, thought about more critically. And so as I detail in the book, the Moroccans in 1811, they send a delegation to talk with the Wahhabis. Arguably, I'm not trying to suggest that the Wahhabis are a mainstream movement by any means. I think, this was a very pragmatic gesture. Basically, there had been an understanding after several attacks on Hajj caravans by the nascent Wahhabi group after they took over the Hejaz in the early 1800s, that Hajj was not going to be permissible, right? Because you were in danger, you're taking your life in your hands, and you could get raided by these people. So the Moroccan delegation is clearly seeking certain assurances that they can send their Hajj delegations, right? And to the best of my knowledge, I think from that period, 1811 until the son of Ibrahim Pasha, the son of Muhammad Ali Pasha, so-called liberates the Hejaz from the Wahhabis, the Moroccan delegation is the only delegation in the whole Muslim world that's actually permitted to make Hajj. And it had to do with this reconciliation of sorts or mutual understanding. Well, one of the interesting things that happens is that the Moroccans really press the Wahhabis on certain things that they've heard, right? And they force them to recant of certain things that are perceived as innovations, right? One, that you can't make ziyarah to see the Prophet, that you don't believe that there are awliya Allah, that there are saints of, or friends of God, right? And the Wahhabi delegation, which includes the king of Saudi Arabia, the king of the Sauds at that time, assures him that we agree with visiting the Prophet. We just think that certain people have exaggerated and are making tawaf around. We want to stop that, And yes, we agree that there are awliya Allah, right? That there are saints and friends of God. And so they get them to recant on certain things, but their lingering disagreement is really over takfir, use of takfir and violence, right? In other words, excommunication and the related tendency to kill Muslims by other Muslims. So the Moroccan delegation basically ends by saying, we don't support this in any way. So whatever you're doing is tainted by this. You need to stop it. And the Wahhabis say, well, this is what we're doing, right? All this is to say that, there are multiple discourses of reform or revivalism. I think tajdid is a better word here, that are happening in the Muslim world at this time. I think the Tijaniyya is one of them. Wahhabism is a very marginal discourse of reform in the 18th century. And Ahmed Dilal, I think his book, Islam Without Europe, already proves that point. I don't need to keep beating a dead horse. And he basically says that the Wahhabis are really disconnected. They're really an exception to this intellectual vibrancy that's going on in the 18th century, even though they claim to be connected to these different scholarly networks. Moulay Suleiman, who may or may not have been a Tijani, I think the evidence tends in the direction that he was, initiated a very important reformist agenda in Morocco that, other scholars have mistakenly assumed that he was influenced by the Wahhabis. But in fact, he's, influenced by this sort of revivalism that's happening, arguably a Tariqa Muhammadiyah kind of methodology, right? The idea of connecting Islamic jurisprudence, theology, and Sufism to the Sunnah of the Prophet. So that's but there are other kind of social contexts. We've talked about the political contexts that are going on. And I think you rightly referenced this kind of dispute between the Ottomans and the Moroccan Sultanate, the Alawite dynasty. I think that can be overdone. It's clear that Sheikh Marjani has particular problems with certain Ottoman officials, namely in Algiers and Tlemcen, so particular governors. But he has good relations with the Ottoman Bey in Tunisia, for example, and later Tijani's, did travel to Istanbul. And there's even a Mauritanian / Sudanese scholar that visits Sultan Abdulhamid II some generations later and allegedly initiates him into the Tijaniyya. But it seems that the Sultan at that time was taking multiple Tariqa affiliations. So there's this, political issue. There are other real social issues that I think the Tijaniyya is responding to. I'm particularly fascinated by these questions because I think that oftentimes this helps us understand why people are actually coming to Sheikh Marjani in real time and rather than the sort of lofty metaphysical elaborations that are often there in the Juhayr Rahmani and other sources. His stance, for example, on, apparently on race relations, right? He seems to be kind of pushing against the marginalization of Black people in his early community, right? And raising up people of formerly slave Black African background to kind of high positions of spiritual authority. He is also, I'm not claiming by any means he was an abolitionist. I think that would be an anachronism, but he's thought to have spent all of his money on trying to free slaves. We know that slavery was an increasingly sticky problem in Morocco during the time, right? Namely because many of the people that were brought into Morocco were from sub-Saharan Africa, and many of them were from Muslim backgrounds themselves, right? So this was a problem, he literally curses, and you don't find Sheikh Marjani doing that often, but he finds somebody that a slave who is going around in Fez without a warm enough winter coat. And he curses the owner for mistreating that slave, right? That's a pretty serious reaction. And in another instance, he has this very interesting statement where he says, I advise you to treat this slave well. I am the one who has been sold, right? In other words, he's creating this sort of common humanity between himself as this illustrious Sharif and scholar and the kind of downtrodden of North African society at the time. He has, these interesting statements about sugar being mixed with blood. He's also making certain economic statements, and he himself is giving up sugar, he thinks. And I'm, I was speculating that, this could be an interjection or something about the transatlantic slave trade, given that sugar was emanating mostly from the Caribbean during this time, passing through Europe and quite literally mixed with the blood of slaves. Right? But there are also questions about tobacco that are, also kind of indicate that Sheikh Marjani was socially engaged and was involved in the kind of the key issues of his time, right? And Moulay Suleiman, the king of Morocco at the time, actually bans the tobacco trade, even though tobacco is very profitable for Morocco during this time. So these are some of the kind of broader social and political contexts of the time that I think, I think just things about these statements about, baraka ta'am, baraka salat fi makaniha, he says, that the blessing of food or feeding people is the same as the blessing of prayer in the mosque, right? And he's known to host people and feed them. And at least one of the great who was a great propagator of the Tijaniya later on and a great scholar, admits that he first came to see Shyamunarjani because the food was so good. So I think these are important kind of social questions that you have to look a little bit more closely in the primary sources, but they're there if you know what you're looking for.
And I think, you know, I really enjoyed the book for that reason, is the contextualization that you provide, and especially across, you know, like metaphysical realities. We didn't get to talk about chapter 4 that much, but on sainthood and, you know, connections with Ibn al-Arabi and the ideas of the hidden pole, or in the chapter 5, we talk about gratitude. So I think there's just so much detail in the book that I really appreciate it. So I'm grateful to that, but I'm also mindful of your time. So I wonder if you could let us know what you're working on now, or if you hopefully maybe taking a break also, but what we can expect from you in terms of future work, if you have anything in the pipeline.
Yeah, thanks for asking. So what I've done now is in support of this project, and also to plug in with some of the things that were going on previously with my kind of academic networks, is this thing called the Tijani Literature Project. And it's basically to produce a bibliographical reference, probably we'll submit it to Brill or something like that, that, you know, looks at the Tijaniya as a sort of, an amorphous group, and we realize that it's problematic to sort of close it down like that. But that, you know, thinks of is at least a window into the intellectual vibrancy of an important tradition, named particularly in North and West Africa. So it kind of creates a reference of the major authors and what they were writing and where you can find those texts. And we've really seen explosions in literature that's very difficult, you know, for, so my text, my book, Realizing Islam, only was really scratching the surface of that stuff that came later on. And so we, a former advisor of mine, Rudiger Seizemann, had started that project with funding from Ford Foundation. He since moved into administration and other things. So the idea is to kind of return, but also to kind of digitize that project a bit more. So I've created a website called tijani.org, and it's a basic, so, and I've created a research council of about 30 plus scholars, both academic and Tijani scholars themselves, to kind of help upload, make available primary source material in PDF form. We also have a file storage service on the back end that we can upload documents to our and share among ourselves and think about creating this publication later on. But in terms of actual things that I'm working on right now, I'm actually moving back a bit earlier to scholarship in Timbuktu. I'm working with two other scholars to produce a new translation of the Tarikh al-Fattash, which is one of the two primary sources for the history of Timbuktu. And it turns out that this book was actually manipulated in the 19th century, and things were added. So we're basically pulling back the original, finding the original text, which we're calling the Tarikh ibn Mukhtar. So it doesn't really relate to the Tijaniya or Sufism in particular, but it is thinking about, you know, I guess similar questions of scholarly dynamism, but of a bit earlier period coming out of West Africa. And this is one of the points that I really wanted to make with this book about the Tijaniya, was to highlight the ways in which Islamic scholarship in West Africa had were really part of this conversation, had always been part of this conversation. And so that, I think, is a broader continuity to my work that's predated the book on, you know, on the Tijaniya, and is now going forward. Also, this kind of this fascination with Islamic intellectual vibrancy in sub-Saharan Africa.
Both of the projects seems amazing, and especially the digital database. I think it's so important. And you know, your book, as I didn't mention during our conversation yet, but is open access. So I think the idea that these sources are open access and available to people is also so important. So I commend you for ensuring that that's something that you're doing with your own scholarship. But congratulations again on a fantastic book. And thank you so much also for joining me and having a conversation about it.
It's been my honor. Thank you.
So that was my conversation with Professor Zachary Valentine write about his new book, Realizing Islam. I hope you enjoyed the conversation, and I hope you are staying well wherever you are. And I look forward to having you join me next time on New Books in Islamic Studies. Take care.